Welcome to this special episode of Our Money Power, which was recorded live in a packed room of powerhouse women at the Battery Club in San Francisco. We were so excited to do our first recording with a live audience as part of the Battery Club's Women's History Month program. It was great to have the enthusiasm and engagement from a live audience who also got to ask questions in our wrap-up. In this episode, I'm in conversation with Jamie Allison, the executive director of the Walter and Elise Haas Fund, a major foundation in the San Francisco Bay Area. The conversation was inspired by an article we co-authored earlier this year for the Chronicle of Philanthropy about the ways Melinda French Gates and Mackenzie Scott are shaking up the philanthropic world, not only with the size of their giving, which of course is exceptional, but with the ways they are giving. Mackenzie Scott and Melinda French Gates are making bold money moves that are changing philanthropy for the better, and in doing so, showing the world what happens when women stand in their money power.
When you say, like, are these women doing things differently? Do women do things differently? Yes, and we have to, because we've been in a system where other people, men, have made decisions for us and didn't include us. And so again, one of the things that these two women are modeling is taking their cues from people who have the lived experience, people who are proximate to whatever the challenges are and the potential solutions are.
I'm Kristen Hayden, and that's what's coming up on Our Money Power. Our Money Power is a podcast for women and others like you and me who are ready to own our money conversations, invest with our values, and make money moves that matter. Join us on this journey towards wealth building in conversation with women who are financial experts, leaders in the space, and investors who share this vision that it's time to activate our money power. Wonderful to be here. I'm super excited not only to be with this community at the Battery, but particularly the women of the Battery who are the best. This just feels great to be back doing live events. And I'm especially thrilled to be talking to my dear friend and colleague, Jamie Allison. And tonight's conversation is live. Our Money Power Live. And just to give you a little bit more context, Jamie and myself co-authored an article in the Chronicle of Philanthropy about our proposed scale of Mackenzie Scott and Melinda French Gates, who are, we believe, really changing philanthropy. What we're calling the, what are we calling it, Jamie?
The Melinda Mackenzie scale.
Oh, what beautiful alliteration. And this is about these two famous philanthropists, Mackenzie Scott and Melinda French Gates, who are really changing philanthropy, as women do when women are in charge. And we propose this scale, this new framework that these two women are demonstrating and offering as a way forward for transforming philanthropy. And we just want to be in conversation about it and hear your thoughts, too.
Can I just jump in here for a second, Kristen?
Oh, please.
I'd like to just say that we do refer to Melinda and Mackenzie by their first names. I do not know them personally. And by referring to them by their first names, we mean absolutely no disrespect. However, their names do start with M, which is nice and alliterative. And when we were thinking, when we're having a conversation about this potential scale, it's just a little bit more approachable if we use their first names. So we will be using their first names this evening. Again, not out of any disrespect at all, but because we believe that they are making philanthropy more approachable, more humane, more about our humanity. So we're using their first names.
Thank you for that. Yes. And approachable is the key here. I think that's an aspect of their philanthropy. So let's talk about the origins of this story, Jamie. How did we come up with the scale and more? When did you start to notice that these two women were disrupting the philanthropic sector?
I first started really paying attention to Melinda French Gates when she started Pivotal Ventures as an LLC not as a traditional nonprofit corporation with a 501c3 designation. And that said to me, oh, like this is someone who is about to enter the field of philanthropy differently. There are other philanthropic LLCs, but this is the first time I really started to pay attention.
I also paid attention to Pivotal. The fact that it was focused on women's power and influence, because the statistics are so dismal in philanthropy when it comes to women and girls. Less than 2% of all philanthropic dollars go to women and girls. That is shocking. And so I thought, I similar to you, when she started Pivotal Ventures, I thought, wow, she's dedicating this whole thing to women and girls. And the dollars are significant. It's not like me setting that up.
It's also significant because she was already part of the Gates Foundation. So she already had a philanthropic vehicle, and she decided that she needed another philanthropic and investment vehicle to do the work that she wanted to do on her own terms.
I'm glad you brought that up. It was super noticeable then. And I also want to say, I think it's important to mention that both Jamie and I have experienced receiving some of the funding from either McKinsey or Melinda through the organizations that we've been involved in. So we're also speaking from a personal experience of what it's like to be on the receiving end of that. And in my case with Pivotal Ventures, I had that experience of, we talk about in the scale, this aspect of partnership that I felt that the Pivotal team really wanted not only to give these significant gifts over time, but really work with us as partners. I guess I feel like a lot of people use that lip service, but very few people actually, in terms of the funder grantee experience, that it really feels like a partnership, like we're in this learning together. And I felt that, and that was really distinct. Plus the amount of money. I mean, these were just like really significant, large gifts that were game changing.
I agree with you that they are really good partners and are interested in learning alongside the organizations and the people that they invest in.
And again, I will say that feels really different than the many of the relationships I've had in organizations with institutional funders, where even if they're using the word partner, it does not feel like a partnership. It feels like a top-down, very different dynamic. So that's really significant on the Melinda side. And then there's the McKinsey, the other side of the scale. With McKinsey, it's very much of a hands-off, no strings attached relationship, meaning even if you want to be her partner, you know, not sure where you're going to find
it. No chance.
Yeah, no chance. She's very, not, absent is not the word. It's just hands off.
Yeah, which has some downsides. Like I've definitely heard from organizations who have received money from McKinsey Scott say that when they started to get inquiry calls from the team that does the vetting for her, that they weren't sure that those calls were legitimate.
Because yeah, I heard that
a random person calls and says, I want to talk to you about a potential gift, a potential donation. And then another thing, you know, that is possible because of the way that McKinsey Scott chooses to organize her giving is that there's a lot of opportunity for fraud and scams. So because she doesn't have a website, that creates opportunity for scammers to create websites, to create fake posts on Facebook to say, oh, there's this gift coming your way. Just give us your banking details. And unfortunately, you know, that happens. So there are some drawbacks to the surprise nature of those gifts.
So can you share a little bit of the breakdown of the scale, just big picture of our scale, how they're different?
On one end of the scale, we have Melinda French Gates, whose giving includes having infrastructure. She has infrastructure, she has staff, and there's a methodology to the gifts. Like one can research what her organization cares about and figure out if there's an opportunity and seek out staff to have conversations. And her giving is very much centered on equity, very much centered on gender with a focus on women. And there is a strong intention to take advice from and be heavily influenced by people who are proximate to the issues that Pivotal Ventures is working on. There is also a high degree of trust that happens. Like, the Pivotal does provide general operating support grants. On the other end of the spectrum, you know, we have Mackenzie Scott, who is much more secretive. There's no staffing infrastructure. And while the gifts come without strings, and there's definitely the trust component, there's no partnership, there's no ecosystem of grantees that you become part of and then have an opportunity to learn from in an intentional way. And then there's no opportunity to say to staff or to Mackenzie directly, oh, I work in this particular ecosystem and there are other organizations with whom I cannot work without, and our success is really bound up in each other's success. Please consider these other organizations too. There's no opportunity to do that. In contrast, there is an opportunity to do that on the Melinda side of the scale.
And we're talking about these two women because the significant amount of money that they're giving. And I'm sure many of you have read in the press too that, particularly when it comes to Mackenzie's gifts, more so on the Mackenzie side, it is repeatedly the largest gift that these organizations have ever received in their lifetimes. I feel like I see that again and again and again. And why? Let's talk about, why are we talking about these two? I mean, we could be talking about, it's not like they're the only women donors in the world.
Yeah, I'm glad that you said that, Kristen, because one of the things that would make me really uncomfortable if we didn't talk about tonight is that, yes, these two women are doing something that's remarkable, but they're not doing anything that we didn't already know was important. They're not doing anything that we haven't had, you know, wise, sage people come before and say that we should really be organizing our philanthropy. So, for example, I serve on the board of the Whitman Institute, which is a small philanthropic institution that's headquartered here in San Francisco, but funds nationally. And for the last 20 years, the Whitman Institute has been talking about trust-based philanthropy. In fact, the Whitman Institute coined the term trust-based philanthropy and spun out the Trust-Based Philanthropy Project. But the Whitman Institute has been making grants in $10,000, $25,000 increments. So what makes the difference here is the scale at which Melinda and Mackenzie are making their gifts. And then we've had, you know, other, you know, wise folks, people of color talking to us in more recent years about rethinking our approaches to philanthropy. So I think about the books Winners Take All, Decolonizing Wealth, which when they came out were major critiques of the, you know, sort of philanthropic complex to say that there are ways that philanthropists are holding power for themselves, even as they, I hesitate to use the word pretend, but even as they say that they are benevolent actors in the community. So we've had lots of people critiquing how we approach philanthropy. I think what's different with Melinda and Mackenzie is that they are demonstrating that those books in some ways stop at their critique. They don't say what to do. They'd say, here are all the things we're doing wrong. And what we're seeing with Melinda and Mackenzie is that they are listening to, I don't know that they're directly listening, but they have to be, right? Because we're all reading the same things. They're listening to,
I hope they're listening now.
They're listening to the Whitman Institute's The Winners Take All, the Decolonizing Wealth, and translating that into a philanthropic approach that shows us a different way of behavior in the institutional philanthropic community.
Yeah, I like that you pointed out that about the critiques versus the this is our solution approach. This article actually has gotten great attention in the philanthropic circles and on social media. And I think one of the many comments that I read was about the fact that they appreciated that the scale was actually not like one's bad, one's good, but that they were both different, positive, and just how they were shaking up philanthropy. Jamie, could you comment a little bit about, because let's not assume that everybody is in this philanthropic bubble that exists in our country, but how, for folks that are not in the philanthropic sector, how is this different from how the big boys play?
Oh my gosh, so different. So if you even, like, if we even just take a moment to think about the language we use in the philanthropic sector, it really speaks to the roots of philanthropy in many ways being about masking and managing some business person, I dare say businessman, some business person's public persona. So, you know, philanthropy has been a way for corporations and wealthy businessmen to say, I might be exploiting workers. I might be degrading our environment, but don't look over here. Look over here at this building that has my name on it. Look over here at this room that has my name on it. Look at this hospital. Look at this museum. Look at the good works I'm doing in the community. Never mind the things I'm doing over here that actually degrades the quality of life for everyone. And then I dare say, especially degrades the quality of life for women and people of color. And so if you even look at the language that we use in philanthropy, so for example, in most institutional philanthropies, the primary role of people on the program staff is something called a program officer. And mostly we don't think about what that means, but let's, like, in 2022, if you really care about community, if you really want to be embedded in community, do you really want to show up as an officer, like mm-hmm. a word that, you know, likely came from like the banking and the military sectors and got transposed onto philanthropy? But do you really want to show up in community as an auditor, someone looking for wrongdoing, someone who comes to community to say, I know that I'm going to find something that's off and it's my job to do it. It's my job to hold you accountable and make sure you're meeting my standards. That's a terrible orientation to enter community. So even in some of the language that we use in traditional philanthropy, you know, harkens back to like some of those more corporate hierarchical top-down roots. And what we're getting to see again at scale with Melinda and McKinsey, and there are others doing it too. I'd like to say that the Walter and Elise Haas Fund, where I'm executive director, just eliminated the use of the title program officer for the very reasons that I just described. Like we don't use that terminology anymore.
Was that your influence?
Absolutely. I'm happy to take credit for that. I'm happy to take credit for it.
I mean, this is what happens when you put women in charge.
At Pivotal Ventures, I don't think anyone has the title program officer. I've never met anyone on their team with that title. And then, of course, McKinsey doesn't even have staff, so she's avoiding the whole thing, you know, altogether.
We had an incredible first season at Our Money Power with insightful and inspiring guests. We talked to former U.S. Treasurer Rosie Rios, who helped lead the ongoing effort to get a woman on U.S. currency. We heard from investors like Barbara Clark and Cheryl Conti, who are leading the way in investing in women and women of color founders. And we had a great conversation with former NASA engineer turned VC, Tracy Gray. You can hear all of these episodes and more wherever you subscribe to your podcast, or visit us directly at ourmoneypower.com. It's been so interesting to me to watch how both women have evolved. We talked about Melinda setting up Pivotal in the beginning, and then it's been interesting to see her post-divorce even intensifying her giving to women and girls. And McKinsey now is also stepping up and doing more gender-based giving as well with Melinda. They came together with the Equality Can't Wait competition, but also the big gender fund that has been created, that the two of them stepped up with a commitment towards that over the next 5 years. And then speaking of the evolution in terms of their giving, you've seen the Medium posts that in the beginning, McKinsey listed everybody that she gave money to, and I think the amounts too. And then that changed. She decided that there was too much. This is interesting. Again, in traditional philanthropy, as you were mentioning, people actually often like the spotlight on themselves as donors. And she, McKinsey, was very disturbed that it was all about her and her giving. And she made the very controversial choice, I think that was in her last post in December, to say, I'm giving away this money and I'm leaving it up to the organizations to decide if they want to publicly announce that they receive money from me.
I love that she did that. And I also think there's some subtext, right? So there's what she said about ceding power and allowing organizations to speak for themselves, which I think is important. But then there's also a subtle subtext that I also think that she was speaking to. And that is, I wonder, and I don't know, because I don't know her personally, but I wonder if she also recognized that every time she announced the amount of a gift, if it then de-incentivized other philanthropists
I thought about
being
that too.
Supportive yep. to those organizations as well. So you can imagine, you know, an institutional philanthropy, an individual donor saying, oh, well, if you just got $4 million from McKenzie Scott, you don't need my $100,000 anymore. Thus perpetuating the, you know, scarcity funding cycles that nonprofits experience on a very regular basis. So I applaud her for saying, oh, I need to cede the power and the attention and move it from me as an individual donor. She didn't say it, but as a white woman individual donor, and let the organizations that have received the funding take the spotlight and talk about it if they want to. But I also think that she was being mindful and respectful of the fact that she didn't want to accidentally create excuses for other philanthropists not to invest in the same organizations that she's chosen to invest in.
Yeah, it's again, bold move, controversial. Controversial also around being anonymous, which I know you and I have talked about before.
Well, you know that I respect you. And you know that I love you.
Back at you.
And with love and respect, I know that
here it comes.
You
wait for it.
I know that you, and you're sitting right here, so you can speak for yourself. I should cede my power, the power of my microphone, to you to speak for yourself. But I know that you are an anonymous donor. And what you've said to me in the past is that you believe that anonymity helps to reduce the power imbalance between the donor and the recipient. And I disagree with that point of view for the same reason that, you know, I have some critiques of McKinsey's way of giving. Every time you give anonymously, it robs the recipient of building an authentic relationship with you. It robs the recipient of the opportunity to talk to you again about the larger ecosystem of the work that's happening and potentially introduce you to new potential recipients of your gifts. And it also maintains your power. It means that the recipient doesn't know if that gift is coming or not. It means that the recipient doesn't know if the organization can count on your support and for how long. It also means that the organization doesn't know why you're supporting it. And so if the organization develops some new programs or pivots to do something different, you could say to yourself, not to that organization, because you're not in a relationship, like, oh, I don't like that new direction, I'm out. And that doesn't mean that the organization should keep doing the thing that you want, but the conversation never occurs.
I really respect and love you too. And I appreciate your words. I really do. I feel very mixed about it. And I think it's a good conversation to have. Ultimately, I think removing the power dynamics, and it's ironic, we're talking about our money power. But for me, removing the power dynamics is a big thing, because having been on the other side of that, I think it's really messed up when that exists. I mean, part of when we talk on Our Money Power about having agency in your money power, a healthy relationship with money and what money does, and versus this, again, this like, I have the money, I have the control, and I, you know, may or may not give it to you. And why are you talking to me? Are you talking to me just because you want my money? You know, that dynamic with philanthropists. And so I really want to eradicate that. That's why anonymous giving is appealing. At the same time, I'm very relationship oriented. And I
that is my experience of you.
Yes. So I really appreciate the partnership. See, I'm in the middle of the scale because I like that Melinda, what we were saying with Pivotal, I've also been the beneficiary of that like true partnership. It feels like we're co-creating together. That's why we co-wrote the article together. Women do that really well. I think we need to model more of that collective, like collective giving. Like this is, you know, that's what we do well. I think it's also interesting. Let's just talk about the gender aspect. I mean, they're both recently divorced, and I'm more mentioning this.
Can I cut you off for a second?
Sure.
Since you mentioned this divorce thing, I have to bring up a pet peeve. I feel like whenever I read about either of these women in the Forbes, the Inks, the Fast Company, like those publications, and the article technically is about the philanthropic contributions that these women are making, there's always those four sentences that say something like, these women can give away this money and have wealth because they got divorced and got money in a divorce settlement, as if somehow they didn't earn that money, as if somehow they lack the intellectual capacity to know what to do with money because they were married to men who were wealthy. And we will never see those four sentences in an article about any man who inherited his wealth. I can think of one right now who shall remain nameless because he's like Voldemort. Some people know who I mean. We will never see those four sentences in an article about any man who's ever married into a woman's family who had money. And it is infuriating to me. And I don't understand why editors of those publications don't mark that out before sending those articles to publication.
Oh, hopefully. Thank you. Maybe some people will do it differently after listening to this. Thank you for that. And my point was about the fact that when they were, well, one of them is in a new co-relationship, but just how they were, how they are demonstrating more of their own agency now that they're in control of their own money. And that's why we're talking about them. Because they are like fully stepping into their money power and doing things differently. So let's talk about that gender aspect. I mean, why do you think it's different when women are in charge and women are making these decisions?
One, this is my moment where I get to fangirl and say that I'm really glad that you have this podcast, because I think one of the things that we have to do as women is get way more comfortable talking about money, to each other about money, talking to everybody about money, talking about money all day, every day.
Thank you.
Any time of day.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that.
Thank you for creating a space to normalize talking about money.
Yep.
Because for whatever reason, I can only speak about growing up in this country because this is where I've grown up. Like, we're socialized to believe that we are not supposed to talk about money, and we absolutely need to be talking about money all the time. We need to talk about how much we earn in our jobs and compare notes to make sure that we're being paid fairly. We need to make sure that when we are buying things, that we are buying them at a fair price. We need to be thinking about the investments that we make and our retirement. And we live in a society that says, oh, it's impolite for you to talk about money, particularly as a woman.
That's by design.
And we have to talk about money all the time. So yeah, on the one hand, I think that because these are women, they are doing things differently, because our experience as women is that men have legislated and created policies about what we can and cannot do. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that, you know, all of the ladies in this room, we couldn't have gotten credit cards in our own names without being married or having some man, a father, a brother show up and say, it's okay.
What happens
for her
to someone
to have
like
a credit
me?
Card?
I'm not going to marry a man. No, seriously, do I get a credit card?
I mean, unless you had a brother or a father or an uncle who would show up at a bank with you, you couldn't get credit. It wasn't that long ago that you couldn't get credit in your own name. It wasn't that long ago that if you were a single woman, you couldn't legally take a birth control pill. So when you say, like, are these women doing things differently? Do women do things differently? Yes. And we have to, because we've been in a system where other people, men, have made decisions for us and didn't include us. And so again, one of the things that these two women are modeling that others are doing as well is taking their cues from people who have the lived experience, people who are proximate to whatever the challenges are and the potential solutions are. And that's like, we have to do that. And women embody that, because the moment that we enter the planet in a world where other people try to tell us what we can do with our bodies, what we can do with our finances, where we can go to school, where we can't go to school. And that's absolutely no way to live. And so these women are boldly pushing against that with big dollars. Other women are doing it too. It's just these dollars are so big that they end up in the newspaper about it every day. When I do it, when you do it, we just don't end up in the newspaper, but we're doing it every day in our own way as well.
Thank you for saying all that. What you said about talking about money, the whole taboo around talking about money. If you take anything away from this conversation today, please go talk about money. Talk about money particularly with the young people in your life. I always say it's like a two-prong approach. Like, on the one hand, I feel like many of us are stepping into our own agency around money and having these conversations, having our own aha moments. But more importantly, as importantly, that we don't repeat this, that this doesn't, with the next generation. You all have either daughters, nieces, goddaughters, neighbors, young women in your life. Talk to them about money. Talk to them about money. The whole taboo about money keeps us playing small. That's why I say it's by design. It's actually by design. And that just has to, I mean, stop. The fact that you're all here tonight says a lot about that you're standing in your money power.
Every woman in this room is too big to play small. And you all can't see my eyeballs, but I'm looking at each of you and I'm trying to make eye contact. You are too big to play small.
In season one of Our Money Power, we talk to women inside and outside the financial system, examining the barriers that get in the way of women and money. We're so excited for our next season, where we'll take a deeper dive into the money power we do have as women. I'm Kristen Hayden, and wherever you are in your investment journey and your relationship to money, I welcome you to tune in and learn alongside us. Subscribe now, wherever you get your podcasts, and be the first to know when season two of Our Money Power is released. How does this scale, and what these two women are doing, Melinda French Gates and Mackenzie Scott, what's the takeaway for women listening to this in their own lives?
First, trust your instincts. And don't let anyone talk you out of what you know. Two, I would say that's being modeled well by these two women and modeled by many of the philanthropists that I admire, is center the communities that you care about. You got to take yourself out of the equation and not make your philanthropic giving about you personally, but about the cause and about the people that you are supporting.
I do want to note that these are two white women. Let's talk about that. There was a great report that was recently released, the Portrait Report, led by Holly Lee, about ultra high net worth donors of color and how they give differently. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting to talk about both how donors of color give differently, and it's also important to talk about how donors of color are perceived and treated differently.
Yes, that was in the report that was highlighted. In fact, even though all the researchers of the report were folks of color, even they admitted that they were surprised. They had their own stereotypes about how much wealth these ultra high net worth donors of color would have, could have.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. Like we live in a society that tells a one-sided story about what the lives of people of color look like. We tell a very one-sided story, one-dimensional story about what people of color are capable of. And even when you have the evidence in front of you that that one-dimensional story isn't the full story, it's difficult for people to reckon with it.
The other takeaway was about giving to families, that folks of color philanthropists are more likely to, as part of their philanthropy, give to their own families. And that's not usually counted as philanthropy.
Right. So, you know, one of the things that's interesting about that report that it points out that most of the high net worth people of color who were part of this research earned that money. Most of them did. Some of them inherited wealth, but most did not. And so that meant that it means that they're in families where there is still an opportunity for those who have accumulated a lot of wealth to help and support other people in the family, whether that's, you know, buying your mom a house or making sure nieces and nephews go to college, in a way that for white families that have generational wealth, you don't need to pay for anyone's college education. You don't need to purchase anyone's house because they're going to be provided for through that, for that generational wealth. And so that there, you know, there is that difference. Interestingly, I would also add that there, you know, are studies about what is colloquially referred to as the Black tax. And that when we think about income inequality and wealth inequality, and I'm talking about wealth with a lowercase w, I'm talking about normal people wealth, like do you own your home? Do you have, you know, enough money to send your kids to college? Do you have a retirement savings account? That because families of color, due to systemic racism, sort of start at the bottom rung of the economic ladder, that there are things that middle, upper middle class families of color have to do that white families of color don't have to do, that also include the looking after a grandmother, looking after a mother, looking after nieces and nephews and cousins, that doesn't necessarily happen in white families. So it's true for middle income and upper income Black families, families of color, and also true when you're talking about high net worth families of color.
Yeah, I also thought that was interesting about that they say that often these philanthropists feel that they're overlooked, like they'll, people assume, even grantees assume, oh, this person can only give $5,000 or something when they were prepared to give $25,000 or $100,000. So that was interesting about what our idea about a philanthropist is. I just thought that was important to mention as we're talking about these two famous women, Mackenzie and Melinda, who are in the news, and but just us all to remember that there are also people not in the news that are at play here. And again, what we're proposing is just more importantly that you're somewhere on the scale, that you're participating. And we think these two women are great role models for changing philanthropy and showing us what happens and how people do it differently, how women do it differently when they are in those positions of leadership and having full agency about those decisions.
Yeah, I mean, in all of the giving that we know about that Mackenzie Scott has done and all of the giving that we know about that Melinda French Gates has done, not one of them is named a building after themselves. Like, yeah, not one of them
That's
like
true.
Has a wing of a, you know, it's, I mean, it is very different. Like one of the things that I respect about them is that they are decentering themselves, that this is not about hubris and building a brand in the way that unfortunately institutional philanthropy can sometimes be about.
Yeah, it's I find it very inspiring. And I also, as mentioned earlier, I see that they are both continuing to evolve in their own giving. So I can't wait to see how it continues to change over the next few years. But I really appreciate that not only what they're doing themselves, the modeling, but how they are also very intentionally investing towards women, women of color, and girls having power and influence. It's very exciting to me. And I hope that the next time we talk about the scale, we'll have many, 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 many more examples to mention. Before we open this up to questions, Jamie, I just want to ask you, because it is important at Our Money Power to be thinking again about the next generation as well. Are there young women in your life that you're talking to about money? And could you share some of those conversations and the just advice in general for this audience and folks that are listening to have the kind of money conversations with the next generation?
I love talking about money. I talk to everyone about money. I talk to young women, middle-aged women, old women about money. But to answer your question specifically about young women, absolutely. At the Walter and Elise Haas Fund, where I have the privilege of being the executive director, we have a fellowship program where we welcome high school students to work with us. One of the silver linings of the pandemic is that we've been able to invite young people to work with us year round and not just in the summers, because the fellowship is partially virtual. And we've had a number of young women of color work with us through this fellowship program. And getting to work in philanthropy is the perfect opportunity to talk with young women about money. Just today, I met with one of our fellows and we talked about our personal values and money. So getting to work with the fellows who work with us at the Walter and Elise Haas Fund is one of the ways I get to talk to young people about money on a very regular basis.
I love that you said personal values and money, because the research just shows, and so many of the guests that I talk to on Our Money Power talk about that money, just talking about money for money itself, is really uninteresting to a lot of women. It's part of why women don't like talking about money. I mean, there's many reasons, as we discuss. But the thing that gets women more excited or interested in money is actually when it aligns with their values. Just investing for investing's sake is not interesting. It's like when they say that when women have more money, they are more likely to spend that money on their families, on their communities, whereas men tend to spend it more on themselves. And so you have this ripple effect of this is the power of having more money in the hands of women, because families benefit, communities benefit, the world's benefit. That scale, it just multiplies. More people are impacted. So anyway, I just love that you brought it back to values, because that is actually very motivating for women to have these conversations. So we'd like to open it up to the audience. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you both. I was going to ask about collective giving. So we've seen at the high levels the Giving Pledge, and we've seen here at the Battery and in many other places, giving circles where we band together and give as a group and we learn as a group. Can you talk a little bit about that trend and how that's affecting philanthropy?
I'm happy to start. One, just to stay a little bit on the women that we're spotlighting today, Melinda and Mackenzie, they also pooled funds together to give, to invest in women's causes. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, like Equality Can't Wait.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I referred to that earlier, that whole competition to focus on organizations that were focused on women and girls and coming up with solutions that could scale in the next 5 years. Ignite, the young women's political organization based here in the Bay Area that is national, that I have been involved in, was one of the winners of that. And these were big, bold grants. And in this case, we earned $4 million. That was a form of collective giving. And with I mentioned the gender fund, the international gender fund that's being created is also collective giving. I think, again, that's what women do well. That is a trend in philanthropy and the giving circles. We have examples in our audience within our own community.
Yeah, I have a lot of, I believe that we're going to see more giving circles, more collective giving. If you look at the ways people gave during this COVID crisis, individuals as well as institutional philanthropies recognized that we are better together. Like it's easy to give away money. It's hard to give away money well. And when we get together to give away money, we absolutely make better decisions. And so during this last 2-year period, there have been lots of pooled funds that I've become aware of and that the foundation that I lead participated in, everything from pooled funds to provide relief to immigrant undocumented families in this country, pooled funds to support artists who were unable to earn a living because we couldn't gather and there weren't performances, pooled funds to support and protect and preserve our democracy and ensure access to voting, pooled funds to support a fair census to make sure that everyone was counted. So there have been so many pooled funds and collective giving initiatives in the last 2 years that I've been really excited about. And I hope that there will be more in the future.
Me too. It's a great trend. And women in particular are excited about the whole collective giving. And it also brings out, you know, the best practices, the best of everything. So we can learn from each other. Other questions?
It seems like unrestricted giving, a lot of the work comes up front from a due diligence and making sure that your dollars are being spent well because of the lack of restrictions on the back end. For an individual donor not yet writing $4 million checks with young kids, full-time jobs, etc., like how can we make sure that our dollars are being gifted in a way that is most efficient? Right? I like the concept of unrestricted giving, but I want to make sure it's having the impact I feel I want it to have.
I'm going
to
ask you a quick follow-up question.
Of course.
What might you be nervous about as a donor? Like I want to understand like what the anxiety or pain point might be that you're wondering, like what bad thing are you imagining could happen?
Being in corporate America, like bureaucracy, like the dollars not actually going to the people you're trying to help, like that might be one of the sources of anxiety.
I would caution you to ask yourself some other questions. Someone explained it to me like this once. When you go into a coffee shop and you order your latte, you don't walk in and say, I only want to pay for this cup, the coffee that's in the cup, and the milk that's in the cup. I have no interest in paying for these lights, those staff people who had nothing to do with making this latte, the toilet paper that's in the bathroom, you know, the streaming service that's playing the music while I stand here and wait in line. I don't want to pay for any of those things. I just want to pay for this cup, the coffee that's in the cup, the milk that's in the cup. And maybe it's okay to pay a little bit to this person who just made the latte for me. That's all I want to pay for. We have never walked into a coffee shop and said that. And so when we're thinking about providing contributions to a nonprofit organization, absolutely we want the money that we contribute to go to making the world a better place. I'll just, you know, say it like that easily. But a lot goes into making the world a better place. It means that organization, well, pre-COVID needed an office, depending on what kind of services they're providing. But you know, there's an office that you have rent and you have janitorial services and you have toilet paper and paper towels and you have coffee in that office and all of the staff people that make that go. You have the program people and you have the admin people. All of those things are necessary. It's not inefficient for there to be a program director and an admin assistant and someone who's handling the finances and someone who comes and cleans in the evening and for there to be coffee and snacks in the office. That's not an efficiency. It's what it takes to do the work. And so I think because donors have said, oh my gosh, like, what's your overhead? It looks high. Money isn't going to the people that we care about. Then it means that nonprofits tell us then a false story about what it actually costs to do the work. And rather than talking about the systemic dynamics that create the need for the nonprofit to exist in the first place, we berate the nonprofit to say, you're not doing this work cheaply enough. And I don't think that's fair.
Thank you for saying that. As a social entrepreneur and former social venture founder versus nonprofit, I don't like that word. I will just say that it's like, do your due diligence. That's what I like about what McKinsey's doing. Do your due diligence. But I'm saying, as someone who was in that position, making those decisions every day, like, trust me. This is why trust-based philanthropy is so meaningful. It's like, I am awake every single night. Trust me, please. Like, I know where I need the most money in the most places. And do your due diligence. That's why it's important. But then back the way up, you know, and like, trust that.
Can I also just say, yeah, like, what happens when we get really nitpicky about how much the overhead is? It means that then the nonprofit sector is disincentivized to pay living wages.
Yes.
And who works in the nonprofit sector?
Women.
We do. Women do.
Yeah.
And so what this means is,
yep,
the women cycle. Who work in the nonprofit sector, yep, their wages are depressed.
Yep.
It means that then,
yes, yes,
they struggle to make ends meet. They can't buy a home. They can't save for retirement. They can't go on vacation. They get no joy. And so, you know, like, so we got to be really, really careful when we start to scrutinize, you know, overhead. I personally want to give to organizations that are paying their staff well. Like, I don't want to give to a food bank whose employees are eligible for food stamps. I don't want to give to, you know, a youth development organization and the people who work there can't pay their student loans.
Yeah.
I don't want to give to organizations that are depriving their staff of fair wages and benefits that allow them to live decent lives in the communities that they're trying to serve. We've done the nonprofit sector a disservice if we nickel and dime them to the point that the people who work there work for such low wages that they're practically in the same condition as the people
that
they serve.
It is so true. This is like a painful subject.
We're primarily talking about women and women of color.
Yes,
we start to talk about like who's working and nonprofits doing the service work and not getting paid for it.
Yep. Yep. Okay. Enough on that subject. Thank you. I feel very strongly about everything you just said. And I really appreciate you. I wish more donors had that perspective, but hopefully that'll change. It's a hot topic, so I'm actually so glad that you brought that up. And you can see it's another thing that boils my blood, having been on that side of it. I think we're going to have time for one more question.
Thank you for all your comments. Assuming we're not in the category of ultra wealthy, but we do want to be on the Melinda side of the scale and do some co-learning, what's the best way to approach a nonprofit without then making ourselves central to the gift? So we want to be active, but we don't want to be distracting and taking people's time. We want our cake, eat it too.
Well, I think there's intentionality around it. I just had a phone conversation about this today with a colleague who said, I cannot believe the amount of people who call me, take up all my time and want all my like free advice and expertise and this and that. And then nothing or just like a little bone. And it's like so infuriating. So it's this balance of, learning, genuinely wanting to learn and just being also respectful of folks' time. I think it's also being transparent about this. Like, I want to give a gift. I'm really interested in what you're up to. I also want to like learn alongside you. And asking what would be most supportive to you. I love, there's a, just heard about this Freedom School project that is at Fidelity, that's housed at Fidelity, and going to be working with Fidelity Charitable. With, if any of you have DAFs, you can sign up for this. It's called the Freedom School. And the whole curriculum is based on what social justice leaders have said they would like their ideal relationship with funders to be. Nobody ever asks. And so I guess what I'm just saying is really authentically asking that question. What is going to be most supportive for you? And I, you know, I want to learn. I also want to give, and I don't want to get in your way. I would have appreciated that from several donors in my past.
And I have a couple of additive ideas. One is back to collective giving and giving circles. That's the perfect way to have an opportunity to learn about multiple organizations, but reducing the burden of interacting with multiple potential donors at the same time. And then my other suggestion is that most organizations have public events throughout the year that you could attend. Most organizations are going to have some sort of fundraising event or fundraising gala. They're going to have some kind of exhibit of their work. They're going to create opportunities for the public to learn about them and to be engaged. So for those organizations that are on your radar, the easiest thing to do is if they have a newsletter, sign up for it and watch your inbox for those public opportunities that will present themselves where you can attend, you can learn more about the organization and make your own assessment about whether or not that organization is right for you as a donor without needing to create extra work for anyone on the staff.
And with that, we're going to wrap this up with one final Our Money Power way of doing things. We still have those mics ready, right? I would love to hear from at least three people because we want to be an active learning environment from this conversation. What is one thing that you're going to take away from this conversation around your own money power? Right here.
Always give us a woman.
Thank you. Who else?
Talk more about money.
That's right. And the final wrap.
Do your homework, learn, and trust.
Trust-based philanthropy. Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for being a part of the Our Money Power First Live podcast. Woo-hoo! With Jamie Allison at The Battery Live. We love The Battery community. And really, we want today's conversation to be something that is not just like nice to listen to, but something that you actually activate in your own life. And again, if there's just one takeaway, please talk about money with your women friends, with the young people particularly. Don't stop talking about it. This is how we're going to change the world. That's it for this special episode. To get new episodes delivered directly to you and to check out past episodes, follow or subscribe to Our Money Power. And if you like what you're hearing, please spread the word and help us reach other women and allies by taking just 2 minutes to review us wherever you get your podcasts. To read the Chronicle of Philanthropy article that inspired this episode titled, Will More in Philanthropy Adopt the McKenzie or Melinda Approach to Giving? Visit ourmoneypower.com. I'm Kristen Hayden. Thanks for listening to Our Money Power.